You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Today's guest on the podcast is Dr. Anthony Tingle, an independent researcher who has made 9 trips to Ukraine since the start of the war, most recently returning from Kherson and Mykolaiv. Okay, listeners, a quick note about this episode. It's a little bit different. You're about to listen to a conversation between me and Dr. Anthony Tingle about the evolution of drones, updates on the urban battles of Ukraine. It's a combination of both for his podcast and for my podcast. I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, I just got back. As I told you, we talked about a little bit before, I just got back from Ukraine. Probably 2.5 weeks now. I was in Kherson and Mykolaiv. I've been going to, for the last 3 research trips, this was my 9th research trip since the beginning of the war. The last 3, I've been going in the south. I've been hanging out with the Marines over the summer, some artillery guys last time. This time I was in Kherson for the 2nd time since the summer. It's a different environment than the north and then the Donbas and even Zaporizhia, which is just north of Kherson. It's a different kind of theater of war. They're doing things differently. But like all the cities in Ukraine, they were under they're under air raid attack constantly. I'll tell you the story about Shahed drones, because it's in the news right now a lot, because we're trying to figure out how can we protect our assets from slow moving Shahed one-way drones. But the first morning I woke up in Mykolaiv, which is a city between Odessa and Kherson on the Black Sea, and I woke up to the sounds of explosions and machine gun fire. Because we were fairly close to a strategic asset in the city that the Russians were trying to blow up with Shahed drones. And the curious thing was it was a Trevoha, which is the air alert, but there was no alert because it's going on so frequently now, the Shahed attacks, that sometimes they don't even sound the air alert unless it's cruise missile or ballistic missile attacks, because there's so much Shahed activity. Occasionally, they don't even sound the alarm. But this thing woke me up, and definitely, obviously, not the first time I've been in an air raid, not the first time I've been around Shaheds really closely. When I was in Sumy, I had 2 of them circling overhead the first time I was in Sumy. So I was familiar with the whole situation. But this one was a little bit different because they were coming in at like 30-minute intervals, the Shaheds, instead of swarming. And apparently Zelensky, under pressure from his base or the people in general, because the Russians are attacking the energy infrastructure now, Zelensky ordered the PPO, which is their air defense guys, he ordered them to now concentrate defense on these energy infrastructure things instead of protecting cities in general. So the weird thing is when these Shaheds come in, something I'd never heard in Ukraine during an air attack, instead of one source of machine gun fire, usually a Gepard or a 50 cal technical, I heard 3 going off all at once. So Ukraine has now concentrated their air defenses to protect these energy infrastructure sites. And so I heard what I believe to be a 50 cal, a Gepard, and maybe a ZSU 23mm air defense gun all going off at the same time. And you can tell they're different. You know, 50 cal is boom, 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 boom. And then a Gepard's like, bah, bah. And then the ZSU is like, bum, 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 you know. And then, you know, in the background, there's always that, of the Shaheds.
that's a great audio representation.
That's audio of an air attack, a drone air attack in Ukraine. But yeah, these things were, we are on the ninth floor, which is the top floor of a Soviet apartment building, pretty close to where they were attacking, maybe 2 miles away from where they're actually trying to get at. And these, we were right in the flight path, and these drones kept going over. The Shaheds kept going over. And I, every time I'd hear it off in the distance, I'd rush to the window and I would try to get a video of the Shahed. And after about 2 hours of that, I was just tired, and I stopped doing it. And as soon as I went back into my bunk, lied back down, then one went straight over us, right over the window. And I probably could have hit it with a rock, and I didn't get a video of it. But you know, you probably shouldn't be looking out the window during an air attack, but you listen, Shaheds, another sound. If you've watched videos of Shaheds when they attack, they go because they go into a dive bomb mode when they go into their final descent. So you listen for that if you're lucky. And you're supposed to get two walls between you and the Shahed. But I don't know if that's a good TTP. But I was trying to get a video of of the Shaheds flying around. And most of the time I could hear them explode maybe 2 miles away. You can hear them boom, boom. But one came in really close, shook the whole building, and you could feel the blast wave come through the apartment. And I was like, oh, that it must have been 400 meters away. Mm-hmm. It was really close. There was no targets. It might have been just an errant guidance issue with those things. It's hard to tell because some Shaheds, I think the majority of Shaheds now are still guided by GLONASS and GPS and their LTE, phone system. But now we're seeing more real-time guidance, either through a mesh network or prior to about 2 weeks ago, Starlink was starting to become prevalent on the Shaheds. You could see Shaheds with those little Starlink receivers on top. Obviously, after Elon shut that down a couple of weeks ago, I don't think we're going to be seeing much of those. But the problem with real-time, even a mesh network of the Shaheds, is it allows them to attack moving targets. And that's why we've seen them start to attack the train system in Ukraine, which is disturbing for people like me who enjoy taking the train. You know, I fall asleep in Lviv and I wake up in Kyiv. It's awesome. I mean, the train system has been, it's one of the miracles of this war is how you can take a train across a country that's wider than Texas, you know. And
it seems to be, Tony, and I know this is hard with, you know, two war podcasters walking to a bar. there seems to be two really simultaneous wars going on, this technological competition war involving the drones. And of course, there is the long range strikes and the missile AI enabled targeting. But even this evolution that you're talking about of even, of course, drones, but even the Shahed, I called it a different name when I first started talking about it because I couldn't say it. I won't say it on your podcast. I can't say it on my podcast either, but and the evolutions of it, because I remember when they first hit and you talked about machine guns being used because they are really slow, like a moped motor, really loud. And if you are ahead of it, you can shoot them down with putting lead in front of them.
Yeah.
But that has continued to evolve as you're talking about, and that's just crazy. And Mykolaiv, and I bring it to another theater. Of course, these are greatly expanding. They started in Iran, transferred to Russia. Russia is adapting them. Iran is currently deploying them during the battle. And then we find out that the American took the Shahed, re-engineered it, and then sent them into the Lucas, sent them back at Iran, part of this war. So I think they're a staple, but they both had vulnerabilities and they are evolving rapidly. Like even the, you said, like to do a moving target before, I thought you could, I mean, they were just straight one way, one path from, you know, from whatever they were launched from to the target they hit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's like anything in war, it's a technological back and forth. The difference with this war and now the Iran war might be, depending on how long that goes on, is just the rate of change is so much quicker now. It's the rate of adaption is just outrageously fast. The technological cycle for an FPV drone, for example, is about 3 weeks, to obsolescence, to where they get FPV drones in from the government, let's say, and they're already obsolete technologically. So they have to just basically cannibalize those drones for parts and try to make them useful. But I guess there is sort of a dichotomy in this war, and it's been like that since after Bakhmut, is where this is at the same time, it's a very technological war, very high tech in terms of commercial technology. But also, when you consider things like HIMARS and advanced radars on the F-16s and stuff like that, it's a conventional technological war as well. But from a commercial standpoint, we have reached that point where commercial technology is enabling military attacks. And we've never seen anything like that. We've never seen, we've passed a computing power / propeller magnet threshold in FPVs, for example. And it's a technological war. And on the other side of it, a lot of it is really basic. A lot of it is concertina wire, trenches, machine guns to counter Shaheds. And yes, now they're using Stinger and Octopus drones that are like these 1,000.
I'd love to hear more about that.
I'm not really familiar with that because it's the last time when I was in Kyiv and I was with the PPO and they were doing anti-Shahed operations and I was out in the field with them. That was before they started using the Stinger drones. But I know a little bit about it, just like you do, just from reading about it. But $3,000, they're small, kind of FPV, look like little rocket quadcopter drones. That go up now. The fastest one now, the top speed of that type of drone is now over 400 miles an hour. So it's
designed to do just air to air combat against these things, right?
Yeah, just designed to hit something moving in the air. That's it. It doesn't have a lot of range, obviously, the strength with the Ukrainians is they're distributed. Air defense picture that allows hundreds and hundreds of groups to go out with their technicals and their small drones, like these Stinger drones, and just interdict these Shaheds because they can see them coming from way off. They have acoustic sensors, they have radar sensors, they have other sensors that pick these up, and then those flight paths are distributed to everybody in Ukraine, and they can just see it. Here it comes. Let's get out and shoot it down with a machine gun. I talked about it on my podcast a couple of days ago with a guy that was in Jordan doing air defense right after Tower 22. And he said, look, every base every U.S. base in the Middle East has a different way of doing air defense. And it's not a best practice type thing. And that's why we see, it's really popular in the news this week that, Ukrainians are sending advisors to the Middle East to help the U.S. out. Okay, that's great. That plays well in the news. But how many advisors? What equipment? What are they actually going to do? Because I think the long pole in the tent is that distributed intelligence picture that is not an IC level. For the U.S., it's not a high-level IC intelligence community, satellite, radar, giant radars. It's a small acoustic networks. It's small radar networks that are all distributed. So it takes time to develop those TTPs and those networks in theater.
I'm sure if you're a neighbor of Iran's, that might help you. Said country, maybe that's where the advisors are going to as well. Some of the different countries that would welcome advancing their integrated air defense. Saudi Arabia seems to be doing pretty well, but some of the other countries, not so much.
Well, the interesting thing about Saudi Arabia is, you know, they had that oil field attack that used not Shahed, but pre-Shahed drones. And that was, I'm trying to think, 2019, when they attacked when Iran and maybe the Houthis attacked that oil field. They stopped about half of Saudi's oil production. And those weren't Shaheds, but they were like pre-Shahed drones. And then we see it again now. So it doesn't seem like maybe Saudi Arabia is too reliant on larger air defense systems for counter-ballistic missiles like the Patriot, and has not done well in developing small commercial systems or networks to defeat the small drones.
Yeah. So are we going? You know that I'm the urban guy. And there are these two wars, right? The technological war, and then the World War I-esque static attritional ground war. And I know we talked about, love to talk to you about what you've seen over your visits relating to the urban nature of that, because for me, all roads lead to urban. Well, yeah. I know the battlefield for Ukraine is, it does. All the roads, their logistical hubs, you know, Kherson and the river, which reminds me of like all of the major battles of urban warfare history, whether it's the Volga River, whether it's the Dnipro, whether it's, you know, even in Battle of Way, which is in the news lately, how important that is in the river fight and everything.
Yeah, let's talk about the river fight, because it's an interesting thing that's going on in Kherson specifically. But you're right. Cities are important. As you know, most
decisive
people live in cities. Yeah, they're decisive. Capitals are in cities. And most cities have a river because that's where cities are developed, at the mouths or sides of rivers. So cities with rivers and urban warfare has to take into account these rivers. You're right. There's tons of historical examples. Budapest has a river, the Danube, I think, right there. So the Soviets had to cross that to take over Budapest. Fallujah, more recently, Fallujah has a river. I think we were controlling bridges. I mean, that was decisive.
My last podcast is the 2003 Battle of Baghdad, and how critical, once they passed through the Karbala Gap, the objective to seize the one river over the Euphrates that was vital, vital to the operation. And had they actually blew it. So the Iraqis blew it, but half of the lanes were open. So they were able still to pass tanks over it. But it could have been like the history would have been rewritten had that bridge fallen.
Yeah, you know from studying military history, you know how hard it is to destroy a bridge. Like until we got laser guided bombs, we couldn't even hit bridges from the air, right? You had to send in a bunch of sappers with cutting charges to blow up the pillars, and even then, you know, bridge over the River Kwai type scenarios, even then it's hard, because you can hit with a cluster bomb, right? Still going to be holes. There's going to be holes in that bridge, but okay, we just drive around them. You know, you go real slow, but you can still get a tank across that bridge hard.
That's really from my, you know, all that work, the four trips I did into Kyiv, was I was so impressed by, like, how do you drop all these bridges so rapidly and so effectively?
Yeah, well,
nobody knows.
It's one thing if it's pre-positioned explosives. Like, that's a different thing. If you're ready to do it.
You're the defender. Yeah. If you're ready,
you can take out a bridge. But if you're trying to do it from the air, or you're trying to assault a bridge or do cluster bombs, I mean, just what a pain in the butt. It's not like you can use FPV drones to take out a bridge. That's not going to change.
Right, because There's a really important bridge in Ukraine that they keep attacking, and the Russians still keep repairing it, right?
Tons of bridges. I mean, we tried that in near Suzhou. There were like five bridges in Kursk that the Ukrainians tried to isolate the Russians out of the Sumy area. They just couldn't do it. They kept cluster bombing them. It wasn't completely successful. It's just a hard thing. But Kherson. So let's talk about Kherson, because I just got back from there. And it, I think, other than, you know, a city with a river, this is a pretty unique situation. Let me pull up a map real quick. I think I have a map, a deep state map, and I'll just show that and we can try.
Not that you're a member of the deep state, the
Ukraine map. Okay, so it's in the Kherson, is in the Kherson Oblast, and it is in the southeast of Ukraine, right near Crimea. And it's on the Black Sea. And the Russians had taken over the city in 2022, and they were moving towards Mykolaiv, and they almost got to the outskirts of Mykolaiv, and then they were pushed back in the counteroffensive, and the city was liberated, and the Antonovsky Bridge, which is the main bridge across the Dnipro River, was blown up by the Russians as they did retrograde operations out of the city.
They blew the dam too, right? That was a big deal. They blew the dam too. That
the Novokakhovka dam. Eventually, they blew that, which caused a big floodplain, and because they were worried that the Ukrainians were going to counterattack, and they did try to counterattack in 2023, but it was unsuccessful for a lot of reasons. We could talk about that some other time. But what we have the situation is you have this large city, which still has a population of like 100,000 people, still live in the city. And right across the river, I was probably 400, maybe 500 meters away from where the Russian lines were this last trip, a couple weeks ago. And that's the same for everybody that lives in the city. I mean, they're really close. So it's very unique that the Russians are this close. The Ukrainians cannot go anywhere because they don't have the means. They don't have the resources to leave. So there's a huge population in this city, and the Russians are bombing Kherson daily with everything they got. They use Fab 500, 1500 glide bombs, these huge glide bombs that come in and take out half an apartment building. They're sending artillery, 152 millimeter artillery over the river, just hitting random targets. This is all wanton destruction. This is just complete random killing of civilians. There's no military significance here for the Russians. They're not trying to soften military defenses. They're basically just killing civilians. They're sending drones, FPV drones and Mavic drones with grenades all the time. It's been reported that they use it as a training ground. And they call it the human safari, where they just fly these drones over and try to kill civilians. This summer when I was in Kherson, the first time, I was in basically a billiards parlor having coffee with a guy who was walking his dog one day, and a grenade just fell out of the sky, a Russian grenade, and took his leg off. And he was like an 80-year-old guy walking his dog. It's tragic. This time I sat down with the provincial military governor, I guess, for a lack of a better term, the governor of the oblast, the military region. He said that about 4 to 5 people a day civilians were being killed in Kherson. That's the rate. It's tragic. And there's children there. Children can't go outside to play, obviously. I was in the bunker. I call it a bunker, but it was actually a basement of an apartment building that they had changed to be a playground, basically, for children indoors. So there was trampolines and other gymnastics equipment. There was a table where people were doing crafts. Kids were doing crafts. And I was sitting there, and it's all on generator power, and the artillery is going off in the background, kind of just subtly shaking the building, you know, how artillery does. And I'm just thinking, this has got to be for a child. This has got to be about the worst way to grow up. Next to being in literally being in a concentration camp, this is probably the second worst way to grow up as a child. Just absolutely tragic. But the military situation there, I think, is unique. Not like we talked about, every city under siege probably has a river, any big, large city. So it's not unique in the geography. But I think what is unique is that because of ubiquitous drone ISR and drone warfare, amphibious assaults on the city is not an option for the Russians. If they could muster enough, they don't have any viable amphibious assault landing craft anymore, I think, in the Black Sea. If they do, they've moved them all the way to the east coast of the Black Sea. But if I don't think it's possible for them to mount an amphibious assault to take over the city again. The Ukrainians, if you remember, a place called Kryky, across from Kherson, the Ukrainians attempted the Marines, I think the 36th and the 38th Marines, I think. I might have missed one of the brigades, but they tried to get a beachhead across in 2023 and 24 into the Russian territory, and that was not successful. That was pretty much just trying to survive at the end there. Because of drone warfare, they can see everything. Everybody can see everything, and you can't do anything. You can't move without somebody seeing you and attacking you, either with artillery or with a drone. So it's, unique situation there.
There's just a stalemate?
Yeah, it's just like a lot of the front. It's just a stalemate. Yeah, the one interesting thing about Kherson, when I was there in the summer, there was no drone nets. And then I come back a couple weeks ago, and there is a 10-kilometer drone tunnel inside going into the city. It's four lanes wide, and it's about 15 feet tall, and it covers the sides too. So they have created drone tunnels. When I was first in Kherson this summer, the only place that I knew of drone tunnels was in Pokrovsk. It's just started them.
By tunnels, Tony, you mean basically a net, 360 net over the road so you can drive on the road and not worry about getting hit.
Just a drone tunnel. So actual net. They put these large posts, sometimes they're just sticks. And they're supposed to catch the drones. FPV and maybe grenades, but they don't do very well against grenades, depending on the density of the actual plastic net. Inside the city as well, there is a net ceiling that's not a tunnel per se, but it's a ceiling that goes through the downtown of Kherson, the center of the city. Does an okay job. It gave me a sense of security. It might have been false security, but it doesn't do great at catching the grenades because, they're dense and they'll go right through. But it does catch the FPV drones. And in fact, we were right by downtown in Kherson where the road starts sinking down into the river. So that there's kind of a... you can stand on the main road, and as you go towards the Antonovsky Bridge, the road starts to incline down, and you're going towards the river. And that's when, it kind of gets hairy because there's a line of sight for any kind of snipers to shoot on that road. But I was right at the top of that road, and we had just interviewed a drone battalion commander, and I left it was a pizza restaurant, and I stepped outside to walk into the car, and a Russian FPV drone flew right over my head, and it was carrying, I couldn't tell, it was carrying some kind of looked like a satchel charge thing. It wasn't like a RPG round, but it just kept going. And that was the closest I had been to a Russian FPV drone. And I don't want to be any closer than that ever again. So...
A lot closer than I ever have or want to be. You mentioned the underground playground. What else have you seen? As you know, I study urban, but I also do the underground, and we've talked, you've passed messages about the gas pipe infiltration.
So I mentioned
this
before, and maybe not with you, but I was in Suja in Russia with Ukrainians, and there's a gas pumping station.
Wait, not many people can say that. I can't even say that. I was in Russia.
I don't publicize it much. So, but yes, I was in Russia with the Ukrainians in Suzhou. And there's a large natural gas pumping station there. And so obviously there's big pipes. And one of the things the Russians did when they started their counter assault on the Ukrainians in Kursk is they sent a bunch of guys through these natural gas pipelines. And apparently they did not send them with the proper protective equipment. They just sent them in. The Russians seem really big on assaulting through any underground systems, especially pipelines. They did it in Suzhou in the initial counter assault. And I think some of those guys just died like from exposure, because there must be some nasty stuff. I don't know what liquefied natural gas is composed of or what kind of chemicals are in there, but they're just walking through there. There's videos that the guys took inside the tunnel. Yeah, it's
I've seen those. Yeah, it's wild.
Horrific. If they do survive the initial assault, when they pop out of there, they're going to die of something eventually. It's nasty. And then I believe in Avdiivka, they used a pipeline, like a sewage pipeline, to get behind Ukrainian lines at the silt plant, or I can't remember the exact name of that byproduct of steel making, but they got behind the Ukrainians then. There's a recent video, I think I just sent you, of another pipeline, but the Ukrainians were all over that. They saw them going in, and they saw them coming out on thermal, and they just sent Mavics or Vampire drones and dropped a bunch of grenades and killed them all because they were just on thermal. I mean, they were showing up like it was daylight.
You got to appreciate the naming of these things. I like the Baba Yaga.
Yeah. That's what the Russians call it. Yeah. I think the most popular one that the Ukraine, they call it the Vampire, but yeah, it's pretty much the same thing. Urban warfare, I think, as much as it's stayed the same, I think the introduction of the ISR component into, if I had to say one thing that was most significant that has changed during this war, is just the ubiquitous ISR. They're surveying everything all the time. If it's not with drones, it's with these, I would say very expensive, $1,000, maybe tens of thousands of dollar Chinese high-powered, high-res cameras that they put on smokestacks. And some of these can look out. One Ukrainian communications officer told me that they look out 30 kilometers with 1080p resolution. So if it's not drones, if it's not the shark type surveillance drones flying long loitering out there, they can see you with these cameras. It's very hard to move.
Yeah, then if you do move, you still need to. You need this new level of dispersion there. What I've seen, whether it's in Avdiivka or you go to Severodonetsk or whatever, you got to disperse even if you are being observed.
Yeah, that's
constantly.
So that is both a new and an old phenomenon for the Russians in this war, because for example, in Bakhmut, they were running small squads through the city. Right, they would rush four or five man groups across the street, and most of the time they were hyped up on drugs, and they were the convicts from Wagner, so they got mowed down in quick order. But they were still trying that technique of sending small fire teams in through the city. And what we see recently, which is in the news, anybody that follows this war knows that the Russian tactic now, because they can't do combined warfare en masse with vehicles, because again of constant ISR surveillance and then interdiction by drones and artillery, they use small groups. And what they do is they try to infiltrate these small 3 and 4 man groups, fire teams, as deep into Ukrainian territory behind the lines as they can, which is not hard in certain places because, again, it's 700 miles wide, the front. And there's lots of holes in the front. And if you want to, I mean, if you wanted to sneak all the way to Zaporizhzhia City, yeah, you could do it. I don't know what you're going to do when you get there. But what they're trying to do is infiltrate these small teams and then have them hide out and then eventually meet up with other teams and actually produce some kind of infantry company or infantry platoon to assault the flanks of the Ukrainian defenses because they have no alternative. They can't do armored columns because that's ridiculous. That has a shelf life of about 15 minutes because they can see you from 30 kilometers away and they have plenty of warning. So as you're driving down the road, if they haven't already reseeded that road with anti-tank mines from drones, they're just going to engage you in a kill box with artillery and then finish you off with drones.
Yeah. So. And it's interesting that most other militaries, that unique, really from the beginning, and of course it has evolved, Russian willingness to expend soldiers, whether they were doing the same even in Mariupol before Bakhmut, of sending like the lesser value of troops forward as just the reconnaissance element to discover where formations are. If they die, that's fine. Bring in the artillery. And my friend Jason Giroux will say, oh, it's part of their doctrine. We'll see. But that's, yeah, that's a fascinating evolution as well. How big is the amount of artillery that you've seen across the front lines in your different visits? I know it's ebbed and flowed by intensity.
Yeah, I mean it definitely has ebbed and flowed, and any Ukrainian will tell you that they are very sensitive to shocks to the logistics systems for our artillery. It is kind of, you know, to the artillery guys, and I spent a lot of time with the artillery for the first time this war. I spent some significant time with the artillery this fall in the Mykolaiv front. And so they were hunting guys. They were hunting Russian artillery on that Kinburn spit right across from Mykolaiv, across the Dnipro in the sandy areas. It's a touchy subject. It's almost like the personnel issue with Ukraine, because some units seem to get all the artillery shells and some units don't get the artillery shells. And for example, when General Sursky comes to visit, guess what? That artillery battery magically has a bunch of shells that day. And so they have a bunch of fire missions and they get to fire. I think it's a very touchy subject, and I think they are starving for shells just like they always have since the beginning of this war. I tell this story because perhaps one of the most shocking stories or things that I experienced in Ukraine was, I don't know if I want to reveal what the unit was, but I'll just say, I think I will eventually, but right now I'd just say I was sitting in at the time, it was a battalion talk. This unit is no longer a battalion, but it wasn't that long ago. So that might clue you into who it is. But I was sitting in the battalion talk with the battalion commander, and I was watching real time an infantry armored assault. So 2 Bradleys and 2 Abrams is what they were using to assault a Russian infantry strong point. And, I was watching the drones go out and they send their FPV drones out. And it just so happens that these FPV drones to start to soften up the position and start the assault, you'd see one go out because you can see the video feed because on Delta, everything is distributed. Their intelligence thing is you can see anything.
Delta being the command and control integrated battlefield operating system.
Yeah, they're COPs. They're common operating picture, if you will.
Yep.
So you can see it. You can just click on the thumbnail. If I want to see this drone, I see it. So anyways, long story short, I was watching the drones go out and boop, they go down. Just out of nowhere. Just gone. Okay, they send out another drone. Boop, goes out. Send out another drone. boop, goes out. What was happening was those drones were flying over the Bradleys, and those Bradleys had REB, their electronic warfare suites, on top, and they were burning out their own drones as they were flying over them, boop, dropping them right to the ground. But that's just a side story I thought was interesting about drones. But when I was watching the assault, the artillery was working, and you could see from a Mavic drone was watching the impact area. And one shell, you know, they were working very slowly. It's like, boom. And then they would just fire. And it was like, it wasn't like six guns going off at once, you know. It was just like one gun, boom, boom. And then they hit right in the center of the target. Boom. I'm like, oh, wow. Here we go. Fire for effect. Here go, you know, all six guns are going to start peppering this area because they had it. They had it zeroed in. And that was it. I'm like, oh my God, they don't have any shells to like take advantage of.
Fire for effect. Yeah.
Yeah. For fire. There is no fire for effect. They didn't have the artillery shell. Just one of the, you know, one of the amazing things, like when people ask me, you know, what are some of the lessons that we should learn from this war? And I'm thinking, yeah, there are lessons. Obviously, there's lessons from the largest land war in Europe since World War II.
Right.
We'd be fools not to take lessons away from this. But there are some things that we would never do. Like, we're not going to fight like that. We're not going to, hopefully, we're not going to have, you know, our mobile artillery systems are going to have plenty of shells.
I mean, there's so many elements of the contextual. I know that you and friends like Mike Kaufman and like so many other people that they're not going to make a broad statement like that. There's so many contextuals, or Rob Lee and you know, a lot of the people following this day to day. There's so much context, but people want to go really quickly. Of course, there are lessons, huge lessons, especially for me, urban warfare lessons. But when people try to get a shortcut, just like drones are the future, I'm like, hey, you got to understand the context. If you're talking about Ukraine, you can really dive into, even as you know, different areas along the front line, whether it's the fiber optic meshing everywhere, or like you said, the Shahid variations. You can't just say the future of all warfare is drones. See Ukraine. Like, you've lost all the context of what's going on.
Yeah, even some in a vacuum, some things seem obvious. I mean, I'm fond of saying the tank is dead, and maybe the helicopter, maybe the helicopter is dead. But that's in a vacuum. That is putting one drone team versus one, I'll say Abrams tank with a trophy system, putting one Abrams tank versus one drone team with 20 FPV drones. No contest. There is no contest. That tank does not survive first contact with an 18-year-old kid in a vacuum.
On the open field, in a vacuum.
Well, anywhere. You put it in a building, put it in full defilade. I don't care where you put that tank. You can put it in a turtle shell like the Russians are fond of doing. It will not survive. It will not survive. That's in a vacuum. That does not account for maneuver warfare, and that does not account for the F-35, you know, Joint Strike Fighter, things like that, the way we would fight.
Right. Any tank by itself, I mean, from Suez City to Ukraine, any tank by itself is dead. I'll give you that.
Yeah.
But I'm not going into any urban fight, especially a pre-planned urban fight, without a bulldozer and a tank. Period.
Yeah, you want to have that in, but you're also going to have to defend that in a special way, especially in urban terrain, because you could have made an argument for terrain masking of drone command and control signals in urban terrain before. You can't do that with fiber optic. You know, how much fiber optic do you need in urban terrain to attack a tank? Not that much. Like 5 kilometers, which is nothing. They have 50-kilometer fiber optic drones now.
But doesn't the verticality of the urban terrain negate some of the advantage of fiber optic as it's weaving between buildings?
It could. I mean, it could break. You know, what you don't want is it's pretty stable as long as you don't start doing maneuvers. So yeah, as long as you line, don't right? start, you got to go real slow. Like some of these videos of the fiber optic drone going into a warehouse and then going through the drawers and searching for people. Like you got to go nice and easy so you don't snap that fiber optic cable because it's behind you like 20 kilometers, right? Yeah. So that, yeah, there are some physical restrictions and it is not not a sure thing, but you have to account for that. So if you don't have Absolutely. An electronic warfare package on your tank, I wouldn't want to be on that tank, even in the city, even with terrain masking of tall buildings. It's anything could happen. And as you know, in urban terrain, people can jump out of anywhere. From up below and right in front of you.
Absolutely.
So it's another ball game all completely. But you have to take into account drones in urban terrain now.
Yeah, it's still a combined arms fight.
Yeah.
And it's just, what is your definition of combined arms if you don't have that EW counter drone, counter top-down attack, all of these things, then you'll be found wanting as the Russians have in many cases.
Yeah, and a departure from the way we have fought urban terrain, and correct me if I'm wrong, I see the future of fighting in urban terrain without helicopters. We're going to have to fight either with fast movers, with drones, or with nothing, but you're not going to have helicopters going 150 miles an hour around Mogadishu. This is not RPGs. This is interceptor drones that are going to take you out. That's going to be target number one. So you're not going to have a Black Hawk circling, Venezuela, like, for example, right? Mm. I don't think that you could, you'll be able to do that in the future.
Yeah. Every urban battle is different. Like you said, Venezuela versus, Gaza is going to be different. Yeah. I will say the spike in Los, which actually debuted in Nagorno-Karabakh, but that standoff capability of air assets that gives that Apache or whatever it is that ability to not
what
be
is
over
it?
The
sorry
spike
what
are, in Los the spike in Los it's a it's a missile that was a tank killer in the second Nagorno-Karabakh war. Israel has advanced it. We just bought a bunch of it. It gives you out of line of sight missile, cheaper missile capabilities that can destroy a tank. I think in the urban terrain that you're right. The vulnerability of helicopters is massive and it's always been massive. So a lot of times they get negated, but this, I believe in this new, the spike in Los being added, and we just added it to the Apache. It gives you a lot farther out capability to still have, air attack capability, right? So attack helicopters, right?
It's like a standoff, longer range Hellfire.
Absolutely. You don't need line of sight. I mean, but also it's great again on water. Like there's so many things that are awesome with it. But your general assessment, yes, absolutely. Enemy is the context is important, and what they did in Venezuela was impressive to be able to do that and to create the corridors based on the air threat to still be able to drop special people in special places to do special things.
I mean, it's impressive. I mean, there's technologies. Hopefully there's like black box technologies that we're keeping in reserve, sure. We got a little laser beam or we got something that,
I mean, the iron beam too. I mean, we didn't talk about that, but I mean, it's got its limitations at the moment, but, I just got a brief from the iron here from one of the leads of the iron beam. And it just got deployed last week to knock down some Hezbollah rockets, not missiles, rockets. Mm-hmm. That ability of directed energy to change that whole cost math. And I know for Ukraine, geography, right? It's the whole thing, like it can't do Iron Dome. Iron Dome's limited. But the breakthrough in the optics that have allowed a laser. Of course, you have the big ones on the naval vessels that we're seeing in Iran, but a ground-based system that has a breakthrough in directed energy, how far out it can project your energy to take down at the cost of zero once you get past the fielding of it, will change as we've seen this technological war happening. I think that directed energy will make a big difference for everybody. And there's few countries right now that really have advanced it to the point where it's deployable like this.
Yeah. I'm a laser skeptic. You know, it's always 5 years. It's always 5 years away from operation.
It has been, right? Yeah.
I mean, if you look at Moore's law, someday we will have effective laser beams on the battlefield. I mean, if we keep going, if humanity survives long enough, someday we'll have laser beams. But yeah, I just see a lot of technological issues with them. Like you mentioned, you know, the ability for a laser beam to shoot long distance because of thermal blooming, that laser beam starts out like the size of a pencil. And then a couple miles away, it's, you know, the size of a small car. That's how wide it is. You know, it just gets wider. And so
that's the optic, the adaptive optic breakthrough that's happened.
Yeah.
It's not classified. Don't know how they did it, but they were able to take, you know, it's not one laser. It's a bunch of lasers that they've been able to focus on a pinpoint location to heat up, which is really fascinating when you talk about, because what it's doing is heating up and then breaking apart the missile or the drone or whatever, and how hard it would be to defeat that once this advances. But the fact that they fielded it over the last 2.5 years and the fact that it's fully operational now, I think is really promising. But I've been skeptic from the rail gun, you know, decades ago, the naval rail guns we've been invested in, although we do have lasers fielded right now in our Navy, and that's been a part of the Iran fight. But I understand your skepticism for sure. Yeah.
Until it's, you know, it's just like I had a discussion earlier about the Switchblade drone, the AeroVironment Switchblade drone, and they have two flavors. They have the 300, which is a small, like a small
and grenade,
kills one person maybe.
Yeah.
Then they have the Switchblade 600, which is a tank killer. Yeah. And its combat performance in Ukraine was absolutely dismal. The Ukrainians cannot say enough bad things about the Switchblade drone. So now they have the AeroVironment has adapted the Switchblade drones. They've made some changes. They have a explosively formed penetrator on the 300 now. Okay, until I see it in combat, just like the laser, until I see it in combat, I'm a non-believer until that point, because I can see advances in laser technology, and I can see a laser shooting down a small FPV drone. I can see that in my mind, but can it shoot down 30 FPV drones? Can it do that?
I got to show you the video. Look up the video of what it's done to just this last week in the Hezbollah rockets. But yeah, I believe as well that, you know, that's why I think, you know what, I study lots of areas, and of course, but, you know, necessity is the mother of all innovation. And sometimes there's a failure of imagination, but that innovation has to be to an actual problem, not a believed problem. And a lot of times our R&D gets way ahead of like, well, this is the problem we think you'll have, like, but combat's the true test. And Ukraine has been testing, you know, the realms of what can be done today.
They do a pretty good job of necessity. You know, you can do whatever, like you said, you can make whatever technological breakthrough you want. But if there's no concept of the operation, CONOP, why are you doing that? And Ukraine is, because of necessity, because they're fighting the Russian horde, they don't have a lot of leeway to do science projects. That being said, I've seen some science projects come out of Ukraine as well. Some of these ground robots, some of these unmanned surface vessels that release FPV drones. A lot of that stuff is just Hollywood BS. I don't see it as a viable military technology that's actually going to accomplish anything. So you have to have a CONOP. That's the most important part of technology, I think, in the military.
Yeah, and many of Ukraine's are specific to what they don't have as much as what they have.
Yeah.
So they're innovating based on all the things that they don't have, which goes back to be careful of the lessons that we talked about. Tony, I don't know whose podcast we're on, yours or mine, but
I don't know.
Can't thank you enough for your time and the updates. And
I think I did. I think I spoke most of the time, so maybe I'm on your podcast.
Hey, it works for me. I'll definitely run it.
But I'll publish it too. I did want to get your take on one thing. I want to get your take on a lot of stuff. I didn't let you talk much at this hour, but you know, what is your feeling on the Russian strategy about urban warfare in the Ukraine war in terms of using these cities like Bakhmut, Avdiivka, and now Pokrovsk, using these cities to basically beat their head against them and lose just thousands and thousands of casualties? Why are they doing that? And it's got to be more in depth than, oh, that's just Soviet doctrine. Right. I get it, Soviet doctrine. They want to flatten everything as they move across the fields. I get that, but is it because they just don't have the size of a modern army to fix that city and bypass? Is it because the city itself, from an urban warfare perspective, doesn't really have a center of gravity that they can blitzkrieg onto? Is it because the cities themselves are the objectives? I find that hard to believe in terms of these thousands, like 40,000 dead in Bakhmut by the Russians. That's the high end estimate. Avdiivka, they might have taken 40,000 casualties to take Avdiivka. And now Pokrovsk, which they still, years on, still haven't finally taken the city. They've taken most of it, but who knows how many casualties they've taken. We don't know the number for Pokrovsk yet. So what are they doing? What's your take on it?
So I think it's a combination of many things. And I know that's not since there is no one answer. There's a list of answers. One on the bypass, and they of course still try to bypass that urban terrain, like all militaries do. Even in Zaporizhia right now, they're trying to, of course, bypass and flank, right? So to get out of that, what all militaries don't, I will say, but Bakhmut being very unique, almost like it became a political battle, right? It had no real, even for the front line, tactical value. It became a military. Once Zelensky visited, said the fight for Bakhmut is to fight for Ukraine. It created the Stalingrad effect, where it becomes a political battle. But I will say, on the Russian tactics specifically, I agree. It's not just this is the Soviet way, although there is some of that. Mass still matters, and the Stalinesque quantity has its own quality. But there is also a proficiency level, right? So during these times, especially the Bakhmut fight, when they're rushing, prisoners with zero training, and there are other fronts, even Severodonetsk, with minimum training, and then shoving them into, which is really, all war is hard, but that PhD level of take urban terrain, and you have inexperienced soldiers, it is something very easy. If you dumb down the tactics to what we've seen, some of the Russian handbooks or things that have gotten out, which is something you can hand a soldier with no training and go, this is what we're doing. Okay, you're going to rush, then we're going to follow with artillery. I think that's in there. I also believe that some of these cities are unavoidable, just as they are the objective based on a center point of the logistical hub, right? And that's why some of the fights that we even see right now are critical, because if that, Kramatorsk or something like that, if that logistical hub falls, it is changing the tactical level calculation of the front line, because now this is vulnerable, that logistical line is vulnerable. There's that element of it, where this is why I say, even four going into the fifth year later, the decisive battles are over the urban terrain, period. While all the other fighting is important, and there are many reasons why it either goes really badly, or like in Kherson the first time, it goes, once it's the positional level of advantage, that it goes rapidly because of each one of those cities, depending on what, even Severodonetsk, if you take the high ground on the other side of the river, now you're in a position that makes that, your advantage in that urban terrain less. So each one of those cities, there's a different answer. There is some general answers to one not having a full force. And this is why I think you'd see less urban warfare in the world if people were better at it, right? Why does certain asymmetric people want to pull you into the urban terrain because they get the advantage of it. It's really hard. Mm-hmm. And if you give me enough time, I can teach people how to defend urban terrain and make it even harder.
Right. Well, I think, you know, up to now, the Ukrainians have been happy to let the Russians pound their head Absolutely. Against these cities. If Yes. you want to, if you want to, you know, lose all your troops, fine. But that takes a toll on Ukraine. I mean, they, as we know, and we've, everybody's talked about since the beginning of this war, there is a personnel issue. Yep. Whether you fall out on the side that they're fine and they're going to use robotic machine guns to take care of that personnel issue, or you fall more on my side that, you know, eventually it's, they're going to come time to, you know, they're going to have to pay the piper on this personnel issue eventually. Either way, there is a cost for Ukraine. It may be 1-5, it may be 1-3. But casualty ratio, but whatever it is, Ukraine is not unscathed, even though the Russians are pounding their heads against the cities.
So absolutely.
I guess we'll wait and see, because there's other cities that are coming up. If Pokrovsk falls, like you mentioned, Krematorsk and Slovyansk, maybe Sumy, maybe yep. Kharkiv,
yeah.
You know, there's cities are waiting to be assaulted by the Russians if this war continues.
So absolutely.
I try to put on an optimistic face. I want the Ukrainians to win, as do you, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they have issues. So,
all right, brother. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NWI's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.